Okay, I guess we'll begin unless you saw someone coming from outside. Or, okay. We have a rule that Chazal say that when there's a Torah class, there's a certain amount of reward for the Torah class. And so if you have a lot of people that come to the class, so each one takes a part of that reward. And if you have less people, then each one gets a bigger piece. So that's right. We also have a rule that things that come with difficulty, the reward is much, much greater. It says that it's something that comes with more of a challenge than the person is rewarded for that difficulty. So all of you who made the effort to show up through the rain and the snow and the sleet, certainly we hope that Hashem will pay us back. Torah says, when we left Mitzrayim, it says a very funny thing. After the Kashrus laws, it mentions that right after it reviews all the laws of Kashrus and the animals were allowed to eat and the ones were not allowed to eat, so then it says, because Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim. He took us out of Egypt. And it seems that doesn't really belong there, because Kashrus has nothing to do with being in Egypt. That has to do with being free to serve Hashem, and we were slaves. So Rashi brings an interesting medrash. He says that it would have been worth it to take us out of Egypt just to have us follow the laws of Kashrus. Because by following the laws of Kashrus, we make ourselves holy. And so therefore, for all the other reasons, you know, we were slaves and we were mistreated and we had to become our own nation, but really just in order to follow the laws of Kashrus, in order to be careful what we eat, would be worth it. We're really fortunate to have the laws. And sometimes, you know, we take it for granted. We go to the supermarket and we check and we take something and we put it back. But we don't realize that we get rewarded for each and every time. If you pick the wrong item, if you're searching for an item, we're just used to it. But this is how we're serving Hashem. And therefore, that adds a lot of value to our mitzvah. Okay. So I have a lot of subjects to cover. So we'll just limit questions if we can, if directly on the subject. The first subject I want to talk about is challah, separating of challah. And the first thing to know is that in order to be obligated in challah, you have to have at least 2.6 pounds of flour, which is approximately 8 2/3 cups of flour. So sometimes you have bread machines that make less than 2.6 pounds of flour, and there's no mitzvah to separate challah. Some people think that you only take challah when you make bread. It's not so. If you have cookies or cake and you're using 2.6 pounds of flour, you would also take challah. And there's even a way to take challah on a liquid dough. You can't actually take a handful of the liquid dough, but you bake it and then you separate challah. Now, as far as the bracha, that's already, you need to have more than 2.6 pounds. But if you're using flour in one setting, 2.6 pounds of flour, then you want to make sure that you take off challah. One thing that people aren't aware of, and that is, what do you do with the piece of challah that you separate? So when the Beit HaMikdash stood, when the temple was standing, and the idea was that challah is our bread. Bread is what keeps a person alive. That's our sustenance. That's the life-giving force. And we want to show that we share our bread. Whenever we have a something, we live to share with others. And so therefore, from our bread, from our life-giving bread, we separate a piece for others, which was the Kohen, who was the religious leader, whatever, who did not have, the Kohanim didn't have land. They didn't have their own farms. And so we show that with our daily bread, we are sharing with others. And that's really the foundation of Yiddishkeit, of Judaism, is that we were created to share with others. One of the ideas that we'll see that's coming up with the month of Adar, which is not this month, is the month after that, is that we would give a half shekel. And each Jew would give a half shekel, and together it would make a whole shekel. Because each one of us is a part. And really, that's why man and wife are really, each one is considered a half. And we all know who the better half is, but that's a different story. But each one of us is just a part. And so therefore, part of our mitzvah is to separate part of what we have to show we're thinking of others. And I'll talk a little bit also about Trumas and Maitras, and which basically is a similar concept, that before we eat, we think of others. We share a part with others. And just an interesting aside, that men have a mitzvah of peyus, which is to leave the corner of their face. And again, we don't know the full reason for the Torah, but the word peya is the same word as the corner of the field. The Torah talks about leaving the corners. So just like it mentions to leave the corner of the field for the poor, it mentions that a man isn't supposed to destroy the corner of his face. Now, it could be, there's a different reason. Women don't have lavin. It could be that the Torah didn't want women to have a mitzvah on their face. I really don't want to go into why men or women have certain mitzvahs, but there's an idea that one of the reasons that men have it on their face is a reminder that on our bodies that we leave something for others, that we never take everything just for ourselves, that whatever we do, we have to have parts for others. It's not, we should never think only of ourselves. And that's the idea of peya, which again, it's the Torah uses the same word about the corners of one's face, but the mitzvah is actually by leaving the corners of one's field. And that's the mitzvah by challah, where you take a piece and leave it for the kohen. And that's also the mitzvah by chumas and maestris, where we take a piece and we leave it for the poor and for the kohen and for the levi. Now, today, we live in an imperfect world, and there's a lot of trouble in the world. And we believe that the reason for the troubles are because we've sinned and we're not in the land of Israel, and the world is not in its ideal state. And so one of the reasons, because of that, we can't give challah to anyone. In other words, we'd like to give that little piece of dough to somebody who's hungry. Imagine when we grew up, my parents would always say, you know, you got to eat your whole plate because someone is starving in Africa. And, you know, like if we didn't eat, if somehow, because we left that leftover, somebody was going to go hungry. But the idea here is that we are thinking of others, but we're also reminding ourselves that the world is not in an ideal state and that we still have a lot of work to do. And all of that goes into the mitzvah of challah and truma and mitzvah. So we take the piece of challah and we have to burn it. But since the challah is holy, it's really not kosher in a sense that you're not allowed to eat that little piece that's separated. It's separated for the kohen and it has a holiness to it. And in order to eat something in holiness, we have to be pure, and we have to be a kohen, and we're either some of us are kohanim, or the wives are kohanim, but we're not necessarily, you have to be pure from, there's a ceremony that we have to undergo with purity, and we really can't do that. So basically, we have no choice really but to burn the challah at the moment. Again, it's a reminder that the world's not in its ideal state, but you can't take that piece of challah and burn it in the same place as you're cooking other food, unless you wrap it up with foil. So you want to, yes, there is a mitzvah to burn the challah, but you don't want to leave it open and cooking, because in a way, since it has holiness, it's a holy kosher, it's not kosher in a sense that you could have a real question if you that challah touched other food or came in contact with other things. So typically we burn that separate or we wrap it up very carefully. If you forgot to take challah, which, you know, get distracted, you can take challah after it's baked. If you did it by mistake, you could take off challah afterwards. Okay. Except on Shabbos, by the way. Shabbos, you can't do it. So those are the basic things I just wanted to mention with challah. Just, you know, just simple things that sometimes people may not be aware of. One, as we said again, that you do have to take challah even on liquid dough or cookie dough if you have that amount of dough. And two, to be careful with that piece of dough to wrap it and to burn it. Now, if you forgot to burn it, it's still okay. You haven't done anything wrong. You've done the mitzvah. When we discard the piece of challah, it shouldn't be thrown in the garbage, like in a way that it's mixed with garbage, like in a disdainful way. Like we usually like wrap it up or put it nicely in the garbage so that it's covered, but we don't want to insult the mitzvah, and so that's you know, that's we dispose of it. We like to keep it in its covering and put it away. Yeah. So there's at least two different views. He quotes either 3.675 pounds. Some make a bracha on that, and some only make on 4.95 pounds. 3.675, 12 and a quarter cups. And some people only do it with 16 and a half cups. Okay. Those are the two customs that are brought down here. Oh, either one is fine. Either, whatever the... okay. While we're on the subject of challah, let's talk about the other mitzvahs, as we say, that are a similar vein, which are showing that we're thinking of others and that also we're aware very much that there's much to be done in the world. Yes.
You said you could take it off afterwards.
Yes.
How much would you slice it off?
Or pull off a piece.
Okay, how much would you have to take off? Because when it rises, it's different than when you fall out.
In most cases, a small little ball would be fine. Because we're not really giving it to the poor, and because we're not in the land of Israel, so the amount that you have to give is not so large. In other words, when it's biblical and when we are actually giving it, then we're stricter about, you know, measuring and getting the exact. But with challah, it's like, you know, we take the piece, you know, the size your mother showed you or whatever, or the, you know, even with once it's baked, I think it's not really a, you know, you take a slice or a piece, I think it would be fine.
And then would you burn that too?
Yeah, same thing.
And you made challah for Shabbat, you just made enough for Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
For that, you can't?
On Shabbat itself, you can't. Because it would be fixing.
Right.
You're not allowed to something that is not in its final state. On Shabbos, we're not allowed to finalize things, to take something that we can't use and do a final process. And so taking challah is the fixing of the dough, so to speak. And so if we forgot to do it on beforehand, we wouldn't be able to do it once Shabbos started.
Could you save a piece for after?
Yeah, you could do that after Shabbos. Or that. Okay. Correct. Those are the two views. Now, I brought this, hopefully if we have time, we'll go through the kosher symbols, but also on here is what to do with Israeli produce. Israeli produce is very similar to the mitzvah of challah. You also have a mitzvah of tumas and maaseret. This would apply to any produce that you buy from the land of Israel. And it's a little bit complicated, but it's a mitzvah to support Israel. Sometimes you buy it without realizing it. You don't have to assume it comes from Israel. You don't have to ask. But if you notice that little tag on there that says grown in Israel, then you're obligated. Now, this year we have a problem, which is not, and that is because it's a sabbatical year and the Shemitah year. And so, therefore, produce that's grown in Israel, they're not supposed to export it because you're not supposed to do business with fruits and vegetables in a sabbatical year. So you really shouldn't buy produce that grew in the sabbatical year. It should be avoided. There are certain things that, there's a difference between things that grew last year and things that grew this year, and there's all kinds of lists about what you can buy and what you can't buy. But things that grow in the non, we'll come back to the sabbatical year in a moment, okay? Because sometimes you buy it by mistake, or if you did buy it, what do you do? But first, regular Israeli produce that's not the sabbatical year. Believe it or not, if you buy canned grapefruit in Kroger's, it probably comes from Israel. It'll say on the jar that product it is. For some reason, the canned grapefruit is like a huge Israeli product. Like all year round, you'll see it on certain canned grapefruits. We've seen it on frozen carrots that they grow from the land of Israel, and also on Jaffa oranges, sometimes tomatoes, and sometimes on the colored peppers you'll see come from Israel. So what you want to do basically if it's not a Shemitah concern, which this year it is that you're basically going to take the produce in front of you. Now, we don't make a blessing because what things actually grew in the land of Israel, even if it says product of Israel, there are parts of Israel that are not technically parts of biblical Israel. And so since we're not 100% sure when you buy something, if you're obligated that it grew in the land of Israel, we don't make a bracha. So when we separate something that we buy in Chutzlort that says grown in Israel, we don't do it with a bracha because we're not 100% sure. But what we do is we say the prayers as it's listed here. And now the reason why it's complicated is that there are several different mitzvahs that we have with the produce of Israel. Some goes to the poor, some goes to the Kohen, some goes to the Levi. And some we're supposed to bring up to the land of Israel ourselves. And basically what you do is you separate a piece and you also take a coin. And when you separate the piece and take the coin, you say the prayer that's listed here. And that's it. That's all you have to do. And the piece should be disposed of in a nice way, meaning it can't be like thrown in the garbage. It should just be wrapped and then put away, similar to what we do with the challah. And the same thing with the coin. The coin should not be used.
You can put it in the fish room?
No. because we've transferred some of the holiness of the tithe onto the coin. And today we're unable to bring it up to the temple, and so that's basically explained here. The truth is, it's a much more complicated subject, but in a nutshell, if you happen to buy it and you just want to do it, there's actually a short version of the text here that at the bottom, that's all the way on the right before number 7. And basically, if you're in a rush, you can say that I want to separate Truma and Maaseh according to what it says in the book of Chazdish, separate it and you're done. In other words, you can say the 7 paragraphs, or you could skip to the bottom over here and just say this little version over there and separate it and you're all set. That's basically explained here. That's the procedure for Trumas and Maaseh. Now let's get back to the Shemitah, which is a sabbatical year. So the produce was not supposed to have been exported outside the land of Israel. So that's one problem. Now what happens if we bought it? So there is another problem, and that is we're not supposed to have Shemitah food in our house if there's no longer food available for the poor and for the general community. In other words, the way that Shemitah works is that every farmer is supposed to open his fences and let anybody who wants come and take the fruit of the land. But he is allowed to harvest and bring into his house. But if there's no more fruit available outside, he's not allowed to keep it in his house locked up. That's called the Zman Habir. That means the time when there's no longer food in the field. So the problem here is we have the Shemitah produce here in America, and it may be in Israel that they run out of food in the field. And we don't really know if that's the case or not. So that's the problem with buying the Shemitah produce. Now, if you happen to know that they still have this particular food in the fields of Israel, so then in theory you can buy the Shemitah produce here. But in most cases, if you bought it, you bought it by mistake. So there's not much you can do. But then the question is, well, I want to use it if I bought it. And that's fine, again, you know, as far as using it. But there's one thing to know of, and that is that products that grow during the sabbatical year are holy. And you're not allowed to throw them in the garbage. And you're not allowed to waste them. And the most common Shemitah product is wine. So what happens with wine is typically there's a little bit left in people's glasses, like especially if children, remember, they don't finish it. So if a person used Shemitah wine, they would have to go afterwards. They couldn't just dump all that wine in the sink. They would have to, you know, dump it, and everyone has to finish the whole cup and have to make sure there's no leftovers. And then, if let's say you had a Shemitah pepper and you didn't like some of the seeds, or you cut the ends off, so you want to make sure you use the whole thing. Or if you don't, you save the pits and you save the pieces. And what people typically do is that has to be put away and disposed of it, like in the backyard or in the. What they do is they let it. They have like a Shemitah basket in the backyard that a lot of people keep. But see, the problem is, let's say you bought Shemitah produce last week, and that has been sitting outside for 3-4 days and it's starting to go bad. And then you have this week's Shemitah produce. So if you take this week's leftover pieces and put them together with what you put last week, you're going to be destroying this week's Shemitah produce because you're putting it together with the fruit that's already rotting in the backyard. So you have to have like a different layer for each day's produce. It's a challenge to buy Shemitah produce. So I would suggest, you know, if you do buy it and you want to do the mitzvahs of living in Israel, wonderful, study up on it. And I just want to give you a flavor of what's involved in the Shemitah produce. But you certainly want to finish whatever's on your plate if you're being served Shemitah, you know, because it's holy and we don't want to waste it. Yeah.
How do you know if you have wine that's rich Shemitah?
It'll stay in the bottle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Grape juice also, in theory, it would say it. We'll start seeing it next year for the most part. In other words, many times it doesn't come out until a year or two after Shemitah that you see the produce comes out. It depends on the crop. There's a whole list. Different crops go by different time periods because some of them grew beforehand and they're just harvested now. And what's growing now will be harvested later. In Israel, they keep all kinds of lists for each kind of produce and how it works. And it's pretty complicated. Okay. Moving right along. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about fish. We're going to talk about everything. So in order to be kosher, a fish has to have scales on it. How do we know if a fish is kosher? So the best way is to look for scales. Now, it has to have fins and scales, but if it has scales, it automatically has fins, and so you don't have to worry about looking for a fin. The scale has to be a scale that you can remove it, and it won't damage the skin. If you have to, like, fight with the fish to pull the scale off, that might not be kosher. But it's basically an easily removed scale. So if you don't have any idea what the name of the fish is, you don't know what it is, but you just come somewhere, and there's a fish market, and there's a fish, and you can pull off a scale, that's a kosher fish. Don't worry about it. That's good to go. The name of the fish could be a way to tell if it's kosher because there are kosher fish lists, but there's a problem, and that is some of the names that people use for fish are slang. In other words, what we call the bluefish in Canada might have a different name than what they call the bluefish, and what we call the bluefish, it's two different fish. And so you have to be very careful with the names of the fish. There are certain fish that have very similar names to not kosher fish, and so it can be tricky. But again, if you see a scale, then that's one easy way to identify it. I saw an explanation why scales. Fish that have scales are able to swim upstream. They can go against the current. Whereas a fish that doesn't have scales, it can't go upstream. And therefore, Hashem wants us to always be able to swim against the current, to be able to move along. Also, the fish that don't have scales are more the scavengers of the sea. They eat from the bottom of the sea. But basically, we look for any fish that has scales. That's the kosher sign of the fish. Now, if the fish is kosher, you can buy it. If the fish doesn't have any scales on it because they trimmed it already in the fish store, so then you can't buy it because you have no way of knowing it's a kosher fish. Now, what if they tell you it's a kosher fish? Well, we can't go by just the fact that somebody says this came from a kosher fish. The Torah says the way you identify a fish is if there's a scale on it. So if the fish was totally filleted before you got there, even though they tell you it's this or it's that, we're not allowed to buy it. And actually today it's relatively common that there's a big market for fish forgeries where they use less expensive fish and pass it off as more expensive fish in the sushi market. And they have ways of actually coloring fish, too, to make them look like different kinds of fish. So it's something to be careful with. There is one exception, according to some rabbis, and that's salmon, because salmon is the only fish that has that deep red color. So there are many opinions that say that you can buy salmon if it's already filleted. And even though there's no scales on it, because you can tell it's salmon a mile away because it's the only fish that has that. See, most fish, they're white or they're black. It could be 100 different fish once it's already filleted. But salmon is unique in that it has that color, and so therefore there are views that you can buy salmon if it's filleted already. But the number one concern that you have when you buy fish is to make sure they're scales. Sometimes they leave the head on, or they leave the tail, or they leave an area of skin, and then you can identify it as kosher. The second problem you have when you buy fish, if they cut off part, is that maybe the knife that they used to cut the fish was used to cut non-kosher fish. And that's a problem. So then what do you do? So let's say you can tell it's a kosher fish either because it's salmon, or they left a piece of skin on and you see a scale. So Minat Torah, this is a kosher fish because you can tell it has a scale or it's salmon. But it has a problem with the knife. So here there are different views as to how far you have to go to clean off the fish from the non-kosher knife. The strictest view would be to cut away the layer where the knife touched. The less strict view would be to scrub it real well. So again, what happened here was you bought a fish that you know is a kosher fish. You see, it could be you even saw them cut off the scales. But they used a knife that had fish oil on it that was used for a shrimp or crab or lobster or something else. So, again, there's two views. One view is you can just take it home and scrub it and do what's like shishu, like wash it really, really well. And since the knife was non-kosher, but it was cold, if you wash it and scrub it really well, then that non-kosher fish oil that might have been used will come off. The other view is you should scrape it and like cut away the area where the knife touched. A better way, if possible, is have them cut it with your knife, with a kosher knife, and then you don't have them put a piece of paper down. Now, it used to be that everybody did that, But now people are reluctant to carry along big knives in places, and sometimes they don't want to use your knife because it's not a professional fish cutting knife. What you can ask is if they can clean their knife for you. Meaning, some of the places have like a dishwasher made for knives where they'll clean it, and they can show it to you, and you can see if it was done perfectly clean. They can put it through boiling hot water and soap. And basically, after it's like a film on these knives because it cuts fish. It's like a gooey film. And so they might tell you it's clean, but all you have to do is take a cloth and, you know, run it along the edge of the knife. And if it's oily, then you know it needs to. But if they'll clean their knife with hot water and soap, and it doesn't have that film, and they'll put down paper, then they can cut the fish in front of you, and it's perfectly good to go. You're your own mashiach, but that's fine. You know, that's no problem. So if you don't have like a kosher department that actually cuts the fish for you, and you want to go to a regular place where they cut other fish, so again, the most important thing is identify it as a kosher fish, either with the scales or with the salmon, we said, according to some views, by the color. And then if they already cut it and they might have used a non-kosher knife, then you can take it home, either follow the leading view and do the shuf-shuf, the rubbing and the scrubbing of the fish, which is not a bad idea anyway. You never know how clean it is in those places. Or you can scrape it and cut away a layer. Or even better, if they're cooperative, you can just ask them to clean their knife or to sanitize it, and they have special chemicals. And in theory, they should clean it well anyway, but it could be they only do it at the end of a shift. So you can ask them to, you know, do a special cleaning on their knife, test it with a napkin or something. If it's perfectly clean and they put down paper, then they can cut it for you, and it's good to go right then and there. Yeah.
What about frozen fish fillets?
So that would be the same issue. So if it's salmon, so at least you know it's kosher, so then frozen fish fillets are actually a little better, because when they do them in the, when they fillet them, they do hundreds at a time. So there is some view that it's less of a problem of the knife, whereas in the supermarkets, they almost always use the same knife, in other words. The problem is that if it's not salmon and there's no scales on it, there's no way to know that it's kosher. Even
in the bag, like it's salmon or something?
If they left the skin on and they left scales on, then it's okay.
But even though it's...
Oh, if it has a hexer, that's fine. That's no problem. Yeah.
Well, I've never seen
a frozen
fish.
Yeah. A Kroger has it, Sam's Club has it, yeah. There's some from South America that have it on there.
Have you heard experience, other than the bags that have the extra, or in our Kroger or public, like with the farmer's market, do you have any experience there as to what...
It really depends. If they're not busy, people generally will be very cooperative and very happy to do it. If they're busy, it's much harder. Yeah, I think people are more cautious now about bringing your own knife. Okay. Moving along with the fish. Okay. Okay, I have a few sheets here. So let's start off with the most controversial one, and then we'll get to the this sheet here, which we refuse to sign our name. There are many companies that they often get this claim, like, if it says it's kosher, then that means it's kosher. Why wouldn't it be? Or if they say they're a rabbi, so. I'm always surprised by people, because if you just listen to the radio, they'll tell you that you can. They had a pill that you could take at night that you could lose weight in your sleep. It melts away the fat while you're sleeping, or it can make you grow hair, or make all your wrinkles disappear and make you younger. And they make these claims. Anybody can make any claim that they want. It's a free country, and basically there is no protection out there from somebody saying something is kosher, and they have a good reason to say it's kosher, because there are people that will buy it. There are people that prefer products that are kosher. And unless you can prove that they intend to deceive you, which is very difficult to prove, unless you have a lawyer, and unless you live in the right state that has the laws, that have the teeth of the laws to prosecute, they get away with it. And so there really is very little kosher protection for consumers. And so just because an item says it's kosher, it's like a claim that something is healthy or makes all the other claims that are out there, the fact that something says it's kosher doesn't mean that it's so. Now, a K is actually worse than that, because somebody put a K on ham or pork or something like that, and they somebody said, you can't do that. K stands for kosher. And they had a lawsuit, and the judges decided that you can't copyright a letter of the alphabet. So anybody who wants to can put a K, and there are companies that use a K like Kroger, Big K Soda. Big K doesn't stand for Big Kosher, it stands for Kroger. And so a K really means nothing. We had an agency that was doing, there's two kinds of symbols on here. The ones that are on the right, are the white, are all no good. The ones on the left are gray. The ones in the newsletter are all reliable. Correct. So now let me explain a little bit about it. In the perfect world, it would be nice if everything was either good or no good. But there are some that are in between. It means that some people accept them and some people don't. And there are different reasons for that. It would be similar to, what if you had someone that invited you over to their house and you knew they weren't as careful as you are, or they weren't as observant as you are. So they say they keep kosher. Do you eat there? Well, some people, they eat anywhere. They want to be friendly. Other people say, well, I'm only comfortable. What about if the person is newly kosher and they just aren't that familiar with all the rules, and so you're not comfortable going there because you think that they maybe haven't learned, don't know that much, or maybe you feel that by going there you'll encourage them. There are different views about what to do with something that's not quite there yet or that's learning. And the same thing is with kosher symbols, believe it or not. There are some that are 100%, they're nonprofit agencies, they do it full time, they are set up and they try to do the job as best they can. And then there are other ones that have made mistakes over the years. And they're not agencies, they're individual rabbis that don't have... I know, for example, that we do kosher certification, and it's very, very complicated. There are many, many ingredients, and there's no way we could any one person can do it by themselves, because you have to be able to have an office where you keep lists of all the ingredients, and you have to have a database, and you have to be able to communicate with other kosher agencies to know what is and what isn't. And if a person is really not doing this full time, he really will make mistakes and may not be on top of things. And so this is the ones on the left. The ones on the left are Orthodox certifications, and they do some supervision. And it depends on who you ask. Some people will say that you can use them, and some people will say you can't. And some people will say it depends on how complicated the item is. In other words, if it's not very complicated, then it's not a big deal. At least it means something. There is some supervision. The ones on the right are zero supervision. I'll give you an example. We got a call once from one of the companies on the right that they asked us to go into one of the companies that they were certifying. And we said, well, we'll be happy to go there for you and see if it's kosher. When was the last time you were there? Oh, it was about 15 years ago. So when they said, well, what do they make? We're not sure. They had no idea what they were certifying. And they said, do you have a contract with them? No. 15 years ago, they sent in a check to their P.O. box, and that was fine. They're just really, these companies on the right just take checks in the mail. They send in a check, and they cash the check, and then they're kosher. And that's really all they are. There's no, you know, some of them, you know, maybe have a rabbi's picture on their website or something, but it really...
Bird's Eye uses the K with
it. Right. The Bird's Eye's gotten away with it because there's only vegetables. So people buy vegetables even without certification. So the fact that it has a K doesn't really, they haven't figured out that if they really needed a certification, anybody who keeps kosher would never use that K.
Is K and Sager within your approved
guide? It's not in our current one.
It's in the
old one. This one is in the older list.
Yeah, it's in the older list.
Okay, yeah.
They make
cheese,
right?
They, Since we printed that, we've taken it off our list of approved. Well, let's put it this way. The KSA?
Yeah.
We judge it on a case-by-case basis. In other words, if it's something more complicated or something, sometimes we look into it a little bit more. So I'll give you an example. They came out with a broccoli slaw that was sold in Publix, and everybody knows that broccoli has a bug concern because broccoli has insects. And so I called them up and said, well, how do you check the broccoli? Because there is no way industrially to have pre-checked broccoli. So I was very interested. And they said, oh, we don't check the broccoli. So I said, well, then why is your kosher symbol on there? They said, oh, we just mean that broccoli is a kosher vegetable, but people have to take it home and check it themselves. And I said, well, look, nobody in Atlanta knows that. I mean, that when you buy a kosher item and you see you assume that it means it's kosher, not that you have to check it. But again, it's an agency that's made a lot of mistakes and is not perhaps as sophisticated as some of the others. Recently, they brought in an outside person to help them make their certification a little bit better. And there are many people that accept them. And I would not tell you you can't use it, but I just, again, this is gray. And we didn't sign our name to it because we don't want anybody to sue us. It is subject to change. But the ones on the left, if it's kosher without supervision, it's fine, even though it has a bad supervision. But if it needs supervision and it has any of these symbols on the left, we don't recommend it. The ones that are gray, if it's not a real complicated thing, then we would probably accept it with one of these symbols. If it is real complicated, it depends. We might call them up and ask them what do they do, how often do they go to the plant. If you aren't that strict, it's certainly, I would say it's kosher, but there are better certifications than the one. There are ones that do a better job and are more thorough and more sophisticated.
Yes.
You would soak it in water and check the water. Hopefully next week I'm going to bring in some stuff and we'll do some checking or some show you how. Yeah.
Is it okay to buy a bag of frozen vegetables?
Sure.
That doesn't
anything on it? Sure. That's on the next list. The next list that we want to cover. Okay. Let's pull out the kosher without a symbols list. We should have that. Okay. These items are items that you can buy without a symbol at all. In other words, if you need a symbol, the best is the two-page list with the symbols. There's a longer list on the Chicago Rabbinical Council website, and we have a link to it on our website, kosheratlanta.org, if you want like a more extensive list of symbols. But they're really every country, every state, every city that has a rabbinical organization has a different symbol. And so we try to put on ones that are very common, but if you travel or you run into something that's unusual, you might find it on that website there. We'll take a quick look at this list.
Kosher hechsher, like
trying to say,
like applesauce?
Well, applesauce doesn't need a hechsher.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Apple juice, whatever.
So our position is that pure juices, other than tomato or grape, do not need a hechsher as long as they're pure juices. So what you want to do with the juice is make sure that it doesn't have any flavoring or coloring added. Sometimes with grapefruit juice, Minute Maid has a very confusing grapefruit juice. It says, Minute Maid and Tropicana, it says 100% grapefruit. It says 100% juice, and it's part grapefruit juice, part grape juice. But it says 100% juice, and then it says grapefruit juice. And it has grape juice mixed in, if you check the ingredients. And so you have to be careful with that. I don't have it on any of these. Half Moon K is very unusual. It used to be on the right side of one that really was not a good certification. It was taken over by reliable kashrus professionals, and they've gone through every single one of the Moon K items. They dropped over 100 companies that really were not kosher, and they're in the process of fixing up the Moon K. So they came out with a statement earlier this year that they felt pretty comfortable to the point where they were basically satisfied with all of the Moon K's out there that were legit. Now, they had a problem, though, they still had this problem, that there are a whole bunch of companies that are still using the Moon K that never officially told the Moon K about it. but because they were never an agency, they really never knew which mooncakes were officially warranted and which ones weren't.
They're out the window.
Well, we don't know, but you can call the mooncake and ask them if it's currently a company that's listed with them. I imagine the larger companies wouldn't do it unless they, you know, they really did have a contract with them. Most companies do actually, you know, get, you know, before they put something on their label, they make sure they're authorized. But for years, the way it was run, nobody, there was no control over it. Now they're trying to control it. So what's happening is the cautious agencies, some of them are being cautious. They want to see, the first person that took over the moon case said he was going to fix everything, and he was gone in 6 months. And then someone else took it over and said he was going to fix something, and he was there a year and a half, and then he left. And then the current group has been there almost 2 years, which is good. And so many of the kosher agencies are saying that they don't want to endorse it until they see that they're really in control of everything. There are other kosher agencies that say, well, look, you know, they're saying that they feel that it's acceptable, and there are many items that are acceptable. We took it off our bad list, but we're kind of waiting to put it on our endorsement list until we see what the mainstream agencies do. Yeah. Yeah, the humpback cave.
What about the cave that goes around that old thing?
That's the same one. They have a few varieties of it. Yeah. Okay. So. Correct. Spice blends always would have to have a hechsher. Well, no, we don't say spice. Right, and then at the end it says spice blends require certification.
Oh, that's interesting. So you don't have to have a hechsher for spice unless you're in a blend.
Correct, that's correct. That's correct. One word of caution, if the spice is toasted, it would need a hechsher. Like toasted garlic, I think they toast, or that would need a hechsher. There are some spices that sound like they're spices but really aren't. For example, like are really blended spices, like let's say like chili powders or something, or chili spice is actually a blend, even though it sounds like it's, you can tell by, if it lists more than one spice, that means it's a blend. If it's a single spice, then it's not a blend and it should be fine. Okay. Wasabi powder also needs a hechsher, even though it's a single, it's usually a blend. If you buy wasabi, it's not a pure spice per se. Curry powder is also like that. It would need a hechsher. So even though we're saying that pure spices are fine, a blended spice such as wasabi or chili powder or curry powder, a barbecue spice would need a hechsher because that's a blend. Plain garlic would be fine. If it's roasted or toasted, it would need a hechsher. If it comes from Israel, then you have to tithe it. Some people... Now, there is an issue, a really interesting issue, and that was when... today, China has become a large manufacturer of products. And when they first started making products, the rabbis researched China, and they found out that it's like the Wild Wild West, like anything goes. So, like in America... If you buy, if you have a canned fruit facility, they won't do meat products in a canned fruit facility. That's why you can buy canned fruit without a hechsher, because they need refrigeration and they need, and typically in a fruit facility, they won't have that. Well, in China, they found that they were doing like shrimp in the middle of a fruit factory because they had no, basically anything went in China. So there were, and there still are, many agencies that don't recommend even items in America and other countries you would buy without a hechsher. If it comes from China, they would say you should only buy it with the hechsher. Last year, we also used to follow that on canned fruits. We recommended on, and we drove people crazy because you couldn't get, what's the oranges? You couldn't, it's very hard to find a mandarin, which is a Chinese orange, not in China. So everybody had trouble buying mandarin orange. But basically, we were following the guidelines that were given to us from the certifying agencies that don't buy anything from China. Last year, the Starcade took off their warning on the canned fruits because China is trying to meet Western standards. So they researched and they made phone calls and they had their man in China check out a lot of the fruit places last year. And they felt now that you could buy mandarin oranges from China. So we took that off our, you know, the list. We now do say you can buy Mandarin oranges, even from China. But since then, they had all these scandals with the pet food from China and all the scandals with the toys and all the other items, which kind of show that it still is the Wild Wild West in China. And so some people do feel that you should be careful with Chinese products. We, because the Starcade does say you can buy the canned fruits, we would accept now the Mandarin oranges even from China. Now, even though there are many products that, like, that are listed here, like the fruits that you can buy or like dry beans, there could be an infestation problem. And that means, and this is coming up with Tu B'Shvat. Sometimes you can buy something with the heksher, the figs or dates, and it's kosher, or it's perfectly kosher, but because of the nature of the item, it's infested. You'll cut it open and you'll find a worm in it. Well, the worm isn't kosher. And even though it has a kosher symbol, if it's an old product, it's been there for a long time, it can become infested. We discovered that many of the barley bags that people use in their cholent, if it's been sitting around a long time in the supermarket, it might be infested, especially the kosher brands, because the kosher brands like Manischewitz or Strikes or those little bags of barley and beans, they sit in a distributor a long time, and they don't have quite the turnover of the regular brands. I mean, sometimes the Publix brand and Kroger brand are infested also. We're not picking on the kosher brand, but a person should be aware that even though an item is kosher, you always have to be on the lookout for infestation. If you see, you know, if you see bugs coming out or you see something unusual, then that you need to be careful with it. On the Tu B'Shvat fruits, we recommend taking, let's say you have figs or dates or apricots, taking three out of the batch and cutting them open. If when you cut them open, they're fine, then you can go ahead and use the rest without cutting them open. The carob, dried carob or buckser, is famous for being infested. It really can be really, really bad because it apparently sits around in warehouses and it just really, and again, we all want to do the mitzvah, but certainly you don't want to bite into a worm or a bug, and, you know, that's grown in different parts of the world. And so it's just a good idea to, you know, break it in a few places and check it and make sure that it's not. Yeah.
What about raspberries?
Yeah, we'll talk about that next week. I want to, raspberries are of a concern because they have the hollow part. So regular berries, at least if you wash them, the bugs will wash off. But raspberries, it's hard to get on the inside. That hollow part, they have like a rim. So sometimes there are bugs under that rim. And so it's a little more complicated how to do it. We'll talk next week. Hopefully we'll be able to go through some of those items. Okay. Now, canned vegetables. So here, see what we said over here. We recommend that canned vegetables have a heksher because some of the canned vegetable places do animal products. Some of them do refried beans, which has lard in it. Some of them will do pork and beans, which has non-kosher product in it. And when you buy canned vegetables in a can, it's been cooked. So if you're buying it, it might have been cooked in the same equipment that cooked something non-kosher. Now, after they cook, let's say, one kind of can, they then sanitize the equipment and steam it out. So, in theory, if they cleaned it out well, it wouldn't hurt the next product in most cases. And so, therefore, in most cases, if you buy a canned vegetable that doesn't have a heksher, it probably could be de facto. And there are people that will say that canned vegetables don't require a heksher. I think we usually say we prefer to have a heksher, because even if it would be kosher, we still wouldn't want to buy a canned vegetable that was cooked in the same cooker as pork and beans or refried beans or any of these products. But if somebody does use canned vegetables without a heksher, but the ingredients are all kosher, there is what to rely on. But we recommend that you pay the nickel and buy the Libby's or the brand that has the OU on it as far as the canned vegetables. Canned fruits, there's no reason to look for a heksher as long as the ingredients are okay. The thing to be aware of is that on the light fruits, sometimes in order to, when they make it light, they take all the sugar out. And it doesn't taste so good. So then they add flavoring to make up for the lack of sugar because they know that you're not going to buy it. So on many of the light varieties, they write the word flavoring. Now, when they write the word flavoring, sometimes they'll write natural flavoring. So that sounds good. It's natural. But the problem is non-kosher things are also natural. Like, you know, meats and pork, and those are also natural.
Arsenic.
All kinds of things are natural, right. So, and when they write the word flavoring, let's say they wrote cherry flavoring, there's no cherry in it. You know, just look at some of the artificial sodas. You'll see there's no... if they write the word flavoring and it doesn't have a kosher symbol, it's like saying, we're not going to tell you what all the ingredients are. So if you want to buy something without a heksher and it says the word flavoring, basically you don't know what's in it. If it just tells you the ingredients, it lists apples, pineapple in its own juice, citric acid, corn syrup, then it's fine. It's no problem. Food cocktail cherries use a coloring that's derived from beetles. And they knew that nobody would buy food cocktail if it said beetle blood on the cover. So what they did is they lobbied the Food and Drug Administration not to have to write the word beetle. And so what they did is it's called a cochineal beetle. So they write the word cochineal extract because they know most Americans don't know that cochineal is a kind of beetle. But it actually, the red that they use in the fruit cocktail cherries in America is actually, almost every case is derived from this cochineal extract. The kosher fruit cocktail with the OU, it's usually from Canada or from the other countries where they use different color red flavoring. Maple syrup. If you buy it in the supermarket, it does not need a heksher as long as it's 100% maple syrup. If you stop at a farm, when the syrup comes out of the tree, they don't want the sap sticking to the tree. So some farmers, they would smear the tree with lard and then let the maple syrup flow out over the lard because this way it won't get stuck in the bark. But the ones that do it professionally to put it in a bottle to sell commercially, they can't do that because, first of all, it would be a labeling nightmare because they'd have to tell you how much fat it is and it would be expensive. And so if you're stopping at a farm in Pennsylvania, you shouldn't buy the 100% maple syrup unless you find out what the farmer, if he uses one of the old-fashioned, you know, farmer's ways of just smearing lard on the tree before they put the tap in. But if you buy it commercially in a jar, it's no problem. Commercially, they don't use the lard on the, smear the on the tree. Pure honey is no problem. Flavored honey needs a heksher. Water is no problem, even though every bottle of water seems to have a heksher. Flavored water would need a heksher, yes.
What do you think you're like driving up into the lawn
and you see these farmers and they have honey in their jars? Mm-hmm. So if the jars were bought brand new, then it's no problem. In other words, there can't... if you can ask them and they have no reason to, in other words, they don't know why you're asking and you say, oh, those are nice canning jars, are they recyclable? And they say, oh yes, we recycle all. So you kind of have to get a sense from them. You can tell by talking to them and they have no special reason to tell you the information that the equipment is new and it's non-problematic, then it would be fine. Okay, we'll take a couple of questions if we can. And should be time for Rabbi Kransky and Rabbi Kwanek.
I have a question about tea.
Uh-huh.
If it is just natural ingredients, like a lot of like Teavana,
uh-huh. They,
most of their teas are having preservatives or added artificial flavors or anything like that. It's like this flour or this.
It would be fine. In other words, as long as it's not flavored. If it's just, sometimes people get confused by it. I think it's called orange piccola. But that's not a flavor, that's a variety of tea leaves. So, or green tea. It's not a flavor, it's just a variety, so that's fine. So, as long as the ingredients are just like the flowers or tea leaves, that's fine. If it's cherry flavored tea, then it would need a heksher.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Drive safely. It's,